You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 300.
Wow. On today's show, we talk about our recent visit to the British Museum.
Let's dig a little deeper and send it all back. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Hello.
It's arbitrarily numbered episode 300. I know this is not arbitrary. It's actual
episode
300.
It is actual episode 300, but what makes it special? Because it's got zeros on the end of it.
It's actually, the funny thing is, it's not actually episode 300 because there's been other unnumbered episodes
in
the middle.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's not actually the 300th episode of this show, but it's the 300th
numbered episode. So It's special.
Yay for numbers.
Yes.
I feel like it's just as special as my astrological sign.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yep.
So we don't really stand on ceremony too much.
No. Yeah. Not so much. But we did think it was kind of cool that, well, you and I have been doing the show together for probably 200 of these episodes.
Yeah, quite a few.
Yeah. So, you know, we just thought it'd be fun to talk about our experience at the British Museum, which is iconic, right?
Yeah.
It's an iconic institution.
Or so they'd like you to believe.
300th episode, right? So they would like you. Well, I mean, it is, though.
Yeah.
The building is cool. Everything about it is really cool. So,
but only if they get to keep their toys.
Oh, we'll talk about that. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't think everybody would go in if it was just a big empty building? It's still a cool building.
Probably not. However, there are ways to acquire things and ways to not acquire things for collections. So we'll talk about we'll talk about that.
Anyway.
But first, we thought, let's talk about logistics, right? Because we were two Americans in London and, you know, it takes a second to figure out the logistics of doing these things. So we thought we'd share our experience here on the show. And then if you guys head over there or whatever, you know, you'll know how we did it. So, yeah.
First thing is, if you're kind of a museum nut and you've got some time and you do want to see a lot of stuff, you need to be there for the entire day.
You do. You might even need to be there for 2 days.
Yeah.
Because we were there for an entire day.
And we didn't see everything.
And we did not see everything.
Yeah. We were okay with it.
We were focused on certain specific areas for sure. And also, it depends on your level of museum nut because, we were reading every sign and stopping and seeing everything.
And we bought the audio guide and we're listening to everything.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that more in a minute, but yeah.
So it's open from 10 to 5 and you have to, again, if you want to be there for the whole day, you've got to get an early ticket. Now the ticket times are every 15 minutes or 20
something
minutes.
Something like that. Yeah. Like a staggered entry, basically.
It's a staggered entry.
Yeah.
And they do say specifically that that time is the time they want you to get into line. Now, we were relatively close. We had to take a cab over to get there.
Yeah, because we just were kind of running late in the morning.
Well, not necessarily.
Not late, but you know.
We didn't want to get there super early anyway.
No, and we decided not to walk because it was just far enough that it felt like it was just not going to work.
We knew we were going to walk for 7 hours during the museum.
We did. Oh.
We're let's take a cab.
And we were both recovering from a cold too. So we had a lot of reasons why we decided to not.
You don't have to justify the cab. It's okay.
But at the same time, it's almost a bad idea though, if you're comfortable walking and you're within walking distance, because the traffic in London might be some of the worst I have ever experienced in my life.
It might be quicker walking.
It might be. Or learning the train system.
Oh, the trains would be quick.
Yeah. We just weren't there long enough to invest the time in learning how to use the system. So we didn't do it. We took a black cab. It was great. He got us there, but it was a lot of traffic and we were there right as our time slot was starting, which means we walked up and we saw this gigantic line and we were like, what is happening? We're not here to stand in line all day. We're here to get in the museum and see stuff.
Yeah. Now I was instantly mad. And when I saw the probably 150 foot long line down the sidewalk outside the entrance of the gates,
it went all the way down and then turned the corner and went down a little further. It was scary long. Crap, are we going to be stuck in an hour long line before we even get in?
However, That went super fast.
So once, fast.
Yeah. And I feel like they were actually holding us for the time. Right?
Yeah, I think so.
And what that line is they take you through a tent that's out in front of the museum that is basically the bag check and metal
security
detector.
Screening, yeah.
If you are bringing a backpack and you've got a bunch of stuff because you're walking around because you're a traveler, listen, if that's the only thing you're doing that day, don't bring a backpack.
Yeah. In retrospect, I probably wouldn't have brought a backpack because it just wasn't necessary. I would have been fine with just my phone in my pocket and in my wallet. And like, that's it, you know,
because you can blow through the security line.
Yeah. They'll let you through a special line if you don't have a bag.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Special line. So,
yep.
Anyway, so the line went super fast. And
it did go fast, even with having a bag to check.
Yeah. With all those people, I swear to God, we were in the front door after the line started moving because we got there probably 5-10 minutes before our time.
Mm-hmm.
And once they started moving us, I mean, it really was probably 10 minutes before we were in the front door.
Yeah.
Literally in the front door.
Very fast. Now, very efficient.
We may have forgot to mention this, but the tickets are free.
Yes, they are free.
Yeah. You just have to get a timed entry.
You do. So do it ahead of time because I think you were looking...
I got them a month ahead of time.
A month. Okay.
It was a month ahead of time. And the 10 o'clock tickets were gone.
Yeah.
Now, there were some tickets later in the afternoon. That's when they opened. And I got 10:15. I can't remember if it was 10:15 or 10:20, but I got like the next time slot.
Yeah.
And it's funny because that whole, like we looked at a couple days because we were there for like 3 or 4 days. They're open every day of the week.
They are.
And like all the entry times were gone. So like Saturday, Sunday, Monday, we went on a Monday.
Yeah.
All the entry times were gone.
Like the first entry?
The first entry time. But the next time was open.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
those must just be the ones that go first because everybody knows that you need a lot of time in the museum.
Yeah.
So try to, and like it doesn't open till 10.
Right.
So yeah. But we went on a Monday, right?
Yeah.
We made that decision because, and it actually worked out really well because we were sick. So when we got to London on like Friday evening, I mean, we were like barely functioning.
Yeah.
And then Saturday we did like just a couple things. We'll talk about that maybe in the third segment. We went to the tower.
We did a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, we did a bunch of stuff.
Anyway,
and then Sunday we did a bunch of stuff too, but like it just wasn't as much as we planned on doing. But I think we both felt better by Monday. So like we were ready to get there and like get a full day of stuff in. But it was Monday.
It was Monday, and one of the downsides of going on more than likely a weekday, probably any weekday, but I don't know if Monday is a particularly good bad day for this, but we got we ended up doing like the same route as these kids, but we got in the school kid route.
We got in the school kid route.
I almost just pulled one of the either teachers or parent,
like,
you know, chaperones aside and said, where are you guys going next?
So that we can like get out of this.
Yeah.
We do not begrudge the school children their time at the museum. It was great. They were doing these cute little interactive exercises where they were running around looking for things
like a scavenger
hunt. I love that for them.
Yeah. They look like they were having a lot of fun.
They did. I didn't
it made it tough for
I didn't love it for me because like I'm trying to read a sign and like there's all these little heads bobbing in front of it and like you can't see around it.
Hey, at least they weren't tall adult heads for you.
They weren't tall adult heads. That's
they
true.
Were short
I
kid
could
heads.
I could lean around them. But anyway, so we did manage to get out of the school kid path eventually and like we're on our own route and then it was fine. Because again, I'm not mad that they were there. I think it was great, but it was like we were just on the same route for a while and it was not cool.
No.
So
yeah.
Anyway.
So
but that was really, it was really great. It was so worth it. And like, there are so many iconic things to see at the British Museum. So like half of the stuff I didn't even know was there because I just don't really pay attention to which museum houses these really important things. So like, it was really cool to see that stuff, but which we'll get into more. But,
yeah. And depending on what direction you go, the first thing that we saw as we were walking through and we looked at the map and we decided because we really wanted to see some Egyptian stuff.
Yes.
And there was lots of cool Egyptian stuff there. But as you're walking into like the Egyptian Assyrian wing, the thing right at the front of the entrance is the Rosetta Stone.
Like the actual Rosetta Stone.
The actual Rosetta Stone.
The one and only. And again, we were there at 10:15 in the morning. So it was like everybody was there crowded in together. So I think in retrospect, again, I would have maybe taken a different route and come back to it later when it was less crowded.
Yeah.
Because we had to like wait in line.
Yeah.
It's true about British people. They will queue up for anything. And like, we were basically like waiting in line to just get close enough to take a picture of the Rosetta Stone.
It was super cool.
But it was really cool. And what we learned while we were waiting to see the Rosetta Stone is that the museum has a really cool audio guide that you can purchase. And
yeah. I think it was like £6 or £7.
It wasn't that much. And we just bought the whole thing for the whole museum. Yeah. It was, they've got QR codes all over the place and like you could just like scan it and then get right into it and figure out whether or not you wanted to pay for it. If you just want to do a partial payment or whatever, like for just some of the wings.
Yeah. So that's another tip. Bring headphones.
Yeah. Because what you and I did, which works really well for iPhone users, is one of us purchased the audio guide, but then we can share audio between two sets of AirPods. So we each had one of our personal, you know, AirPods in, and then we were just listening to it together as we were walking around, which I thought worked way better because it meant we were listening at the same time. And like when we heard the same things, we could interact with each other about it or point or whatever, you know, so that worked.
The nice thing about that too, when you're sharing audio on an iPhone is you can independently control the volume. So if one person wants it a little bit louder than the other person, it's not like you're taking one set of AirPods and one person's using the right and one person's using the left, which we've done before, which some people don't like because that can be kind of gross.
That's gross. I don't need to share things that go into ears with each other. So.
Right. but when you are sharing the audio, you can control the volume independently. Yeah. Now, you can't control it on your AirPod because there's no volume control, but you control it on the device that's controlling the audio. So that was pretty cool.
But I felt like it was super worth it because while there's tons of information on the signs that you can read too, it's just, I don't know.
There's something about hearing it
that makes it so much feel more interactive or something. Well,
and the thing I like about hearing it is sometimes you don't need to stand in front of the object the whole time.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of words on the sign. And to be honest, the audio guide is not just reading the sign.
No.
The audio guide has a lot of extra stuff in it and it's different. It's not the sign.
Yeah.
So you take a look at the object, you take it in, you listen to the audio guide. And when you're done kind of taking it in, you can move on and kind of just like mosey on about or take a step back and let somebody else look at it while you're still listening.
Yeah, totally. I think when we were listening to the Rosetta Stone one, we might have walked around to the backside because there was nobody over there and we had already seen it up close. So we were just listening to it and we didn't have to be in the middle of the crowd while we were listening. So that was super nice. And the information was really, really great. So definitely recommend that, especially if you're like an information junkie like we are. Yeah. And me in particular, like I'm one of those people that'll like read every sign.
Yes. And hey, I want to pause right now. When she says that, she's not lying.
I'm not lying.
Like, so, she reads every sign.
Yes. But I am happy to have an audio guide be my replacement at, you know, 1.5 or 2x speed even, because I think you can speed it up and then you can move a little faster through the museum. So
yes.
And it's all about consuming information, especially if you only have one day there, which like we said, if you want to do the whole thing, just go ahead and get yourself 2 days there. But if you're going to cram it in one day like we did, then the audio guide was the way to go for sure.
I got to say just one more thing about the Rosetta Stone. The one thing that kind of struck me about the Rosetta Stone is before I saw it, I always kind of imagined it as something you could just like carry. Like, here, have you seen my Rosetta Stone?
Here's my Rosetta Stone. Yes. Let me just pull it out of my pocket and show it to you. I have completed it.
Here it is for you to peruse. Rosetta Stone. No, this thing is gigantic. Nobody could have carried it.
No.
It's thick. It's huge.
Yep.
And this is only it's like in fragments, right? They didn't have the rest of it. So when it was completed, it probably would have taken several people to carry. And I'm willing to bet the reason it's broken is because like the dude who completed it was like, okay, it's done. And then people came in to carry it. It was like, are you kidding me? And they dropped it.
And they dropped it. Yeah. Right.
So if you're not familiar with the Rosetta Stone, the cool thing about it is it's in three, it's a single passage and it's not even an important passage. It's just like an announcement of some sort. And it's in three different languages. And it was in Egyptian hieroglyphics and Demotic, which is a cursive form of Egyptian hieroglyphics used for like everyday purposes.
Yep.
And then Greek, in the Greek alphabet. Mm-hmm. So this was used basically to help translate hieroglyphics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, and the Rosetta Stone dates to 196 BCE. Too. Yeah. So that's just, again, you just don't think about how old this stuff is. I mean, I knew it was old, obviously. It had to be because it's hieroglyphs and stuff, but over 2,000 years. And now it's just chilling basically in the entryway of the British Museum. Like if you walk in and just sort of follow the crowds of people, if you go in with a big group, you will be funneled in to see the Rosetta Stone because it's like the piece de resistance, right? Yeah. Like it's like the main focus when you walk into the ancient Egyptian section.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's take a break. And in segment two, we'll just start running through some of the cool stuff that we saw.
Yeah, because there was a lot.
All right, back in a minute. Welcome back to the meaningless episode 300. Aside from it's a cool episode, but otherwise it's meaningless. Don't put any stock in numbers. Numerology is nothing. All right.
I got nothing for you. 300 seems pretty cool to me, so I'm going to take it.
The 300?
I said 300.
We should have talked about Sparta.
Oh, man. We missed a golden opportunity. Oh, my God. Why are we so lame?
We're stupid.
Well, now we're going to talk about the British Museum instead.
Okay.
Some more. Our British listeners are like, guys, we've been there a million times. We don't need to talk about this. How did you not know the Rosetta Stone was there? Like, I mean, I guess I did. I just didn't remember. I don't know. It's fine.
All right. Anyway. So when we went through the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah.
We were in Egypt.
Yeah. In ancient Egypt section.
Although I will say, British Museum, if you're listening.
Doubt it, but go on.
Right. I know you have maps up and around. And maybe we were thrown off by the 1.4 million school children that were there. And other in the normal crowds that were there too.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't as dead as we thought it was going to be on a Monday in early March.
It was not.
Like I just thought it would be dead in there. Yeah. And we did see dead. We just saw the Book of the Dead. But anyway.
We did. But
it just was so many people. And I just want to say that it wasn't as obvious as I thought it should be that we were like which direction we were going in Egypt in time. Like I want to go either new to old or old to new, one of the two. Right. I want to do one of those two things. And then I think we went through part of Egypt and then we ended up in Assyria somewhere. And we went through some Assyria and then we ended up in Egypt again.
We did. It was organized a little bit weirdly. And the way, again, if you're just like following the masses, you end up going into like right in the middle of the Egypt section where the Rosetta Stone is. But actually, you should have started at the far end,
right?
Which is where the older stuff is, and then work your way down past the Rosetta Stone and then past the rest of the newer ancient Egypt stuff and then into Assyria and around. So and this was on the first floor, and it was all the like the statues and the art and stelae and stuff like that. That's what was down there. There are mummies and things, too, which are on the second floor, and we'll get to that in a minute. But that's how they've organized it, is you've got your art and statues and things like that on the first floor.
Yes. And it was impressive. I mean, just seeing all the stuff down there, it was really cool. There's a lot of cat motifs. There was some really cool, I've got some pictures of these, but there's some really cool carved statues and figurines where they're displaying like a box or a structure almost that houses smaller figurines. And I really wish I knew more about it. I would just, we listened to some audio guide stuff, but
I just
really liked those. The intricate details is really what I took away from it. And you know what? The other thing I really took away from this is there is carved inscription all over some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Like literally all over it.
For sure.
And that's something that I think I really didn't expect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, there are some iconic, obviously, I keep using that word, but like that's what the British Museum has, is iconic things. But there are some really iconic statues that we got to see. Like if you think of, you know, the Egyptian pharaoh, right? What you're thinking of is that statue of King Ramses II, right? That, you know, with
you might not know you are.
Yeah, you don't know you are. But when you think of like the headdress, right? Coming down over like the defined pectoral muscles, you know, that like torso up bust of a man with the chin thingy too. That's
Ramses. I wish you could see Rachel's hands right now.
I know. I'm like gesturing wildly all around my chest and head area.
This really needs to be a video podcast.
Oh my God. Nobody would ever watch that. And I would never do it. But so anyway, that's the statue of King Ramses II. And we got to see it.
I hope Tilly takes that part to be our Instagram post.
Tilly, don't do that where I'm talking about gesturing to my chest. Please no. Oh, but you can do it. It's fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I don't know. Like that. I just thought that was so cool to see that because it's just like, it's what you think of when you think of Egypt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we saw a lot of stuff like that, and we can't even list them off here because there's just amazing piece of art and history, one after the other after the other. And yeah, it's just so much.
Yeah. And I actually think while we're actually kind of must stay in Egypt, even though it was chronologically the latter half of our day. And I'm going to talk about the mummies that we saw.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, because those are on the second floor. And it is an interesting decision that they made to separate the mummies from the statues.
Mm-hmm. The mummies were shocking, I have to say.
They were.
Yeah.
They were so cool.
First off, the preservation, and then the sheer number of cat mummies. I got to say, I learned some stuff about cat mummies that I didn't know.
Yeah.
Two statistics that were shocking to me. One, a lot of cat mummies weren't cat mummies at all. They were fakes.
Well, fakes in that they...
parts of the cat were not cat.
Yeah, or they were cobbled together bits from different cats, too, sometimes.
They were just put together to say, here's a cat mummy.
Yeah, and like wrapped up to look like...
wrapped up to look like a cat
mummy, yeah.
Yeah, like they were presented to somebody that wanted a cat mummy.
Which makes you wonder, if there are parts of like 4, 5, 6 different cats in the cat mummy, it's like, well, were they all like the prized cat pets or something like that? No. I don't know.
I think it's like, you know, a lot of businesses today where they just get inundated with requests and things like that. And they just...
oh, they're just like doing the best they can.
They're just doing the best they can. They don't know how to handle it as a business.
But like for a pharaoh or like a super important... No,
you're assuming pharaoh. But the next statistic... that's true.
They weren't necessarily...
the next statistic tells me that everybody was getting cat mummies. Because didn't they say something like 20 to 50,000 some odd cat mummies were transported to the UK and used as fertilizer?
Yeah, they did say something
like
that.
During a period of time?
Like an obscene number of...
an obscene number.
Cat mummies, like priceless ancient objects, cat mummies were sent back to use as fertilizer.
I don't even think they were priceless. They were found in such high quantities.
Yeah, I guess not. If they found so many of them. Yeah.
Yeah, they were just found everywhere, apparently. Yeah, like how many cat mummies, and where were these cat mummies even found? Were they just piles of cat mummies, or were they found in just like everyday grave goods?
Well, I think they were. And I guess that's probably one of the misconceptions about mummies that I kind of just fell into myself right there, which is that mummies, anybody who had money could become a mummy. You know, it's just a way of treating a dead family member. And if you had enough money and probably the right stature as well, you could do it.
You're talking about people, though.
Yeah.
But I think you're totally right. But I would be willing to bet, just like in any economy, that mummifying a person was very different than mummifying
an
animal.
Yeah.
And I'm also willing to bet that, just like in our economy today, that if you were, you know, of a certain economical status, yeah, sure, you could have your mom mummified. But if you're doing it by, you know, Akbar's, you know, out of the wagon mummification,
the, like back alley mummy, mummy group.
Yeah, you might not get mom back. You'll get a mummy back, but it might not be,
well,
you know, the best mummification you could possibly get.
True, but I feel like they might see that in the mummies themselves if they were like cobbled together bits of people, or if it was meant to be a female inside and it was actually a male or something like that.
How would
that,
they know
right?
that though? It's not like they're in. It's
no,
like
today,
in,
today, researchers today would have noted that.
That's what I'm saying, though. How would the researchers even know it today? Because I don't think the mummies of the lower class people, if there were mummies of the lower class people.
Well, I don't think they were. I think this was limited to upper class people who had the
money.
I'm just saying,
if it was done, they would have buried them or something like that. It wouldn't have been in some golden cased coffin with their name on it. That's all I'm saying. Right. So we wouldn't be able to identify and
say,
the name sounds female, but there's a male there. And, you know, we can't really tell that, right?
So. Right. Yes. In other words, the wrappings, and then there's like all kinds of different ways that they were encased. But I think they treated human mummies very carefully, it seems like, from the research that's been
done. The ones that are displayed in the British Museum are all upper class, right? They're pharaohs. They're not necessarily pharaohs.
No, they're like
a lot of pharaohs are down in Egypt. But they're high class, upper class, and they're well done mummifications.
Yeah,
and some of the ones that were really cool though, that include the sarcophagus. I couldn't remember the name of it.
Yeah,
I was going to say coffin, but sarcophagus had well-drawn pictures.
Yeah, they did.
Those were kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were very, very richly decorated. The ones that were, you know, from, again, people who had a lot of money to pay to have this done. So it was definitely a class thing, though. I mean, I don't think the lower classes necessarily had the money to be mummified, you know, so. Which always makes me wonder, what were they doing with their dead? But
you had to be mummified to be mummified. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Some of the cat mummies, though, that one picture I took, they like looked like humans.
Well, the one, there's that one iconic one. Again, I got to stop using that word. But yeah, that's the one that you always see pictures of.
I just showed her a picture of these three that are basically the head, but then it's like a cylinder almost of a body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris is definitely going to share some pictures on the social media.
We'll see. Yeah.
He's definitely going to.
Yeah.
He won't make eye contact with me right now.
It's Tilly I need to share them with.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So the mummies were really cool. And I am used to American museums that might have like one mummy.
Yeah.
And like they, you know, they might have a big thing around it and lots of information, but like there's one mummy.
Yeah.
But these rooms were packed.
Yeah.
To the point where there's a lot of people in there too. It's like one of their most crowded areas. In fact, they don't allow the groups in this area because there's just too many people in there all the time. And it's hard to like see anything. So that's definitely a room that you should visit either early or later, I would say, rather than like we did, which is right in the middle of the day, because it's just always packed with people. But I don't think we even got a chance to like listen to all the different audio sections that we had. And or read everything because it was too many, just too many. There's so many mummies, which I didn't really like research how Egypt feels about the fact that there's tons and tons of mummies in the British Museum. But I imagine it's probably much similar to the Parthenon marbles, which we'll talk about, I guess, probably in segment three at this point. So, yeah.
I mean, that's something that could change as the, because I can't remember if it's finished or not, but as the Grand Egyptian Museum gets finished and fully stocked, imagine they're going to be like knocking on the British Museum's door and going, like, hey
now.
So about those things you've got up there.
Can we have a conversation? Because it's a lot different here than it was 100 years ago.
Right. The British Museum's going to be like, so when we took these, you weren't in control of your country. So we
you said we
else.
Could have them 150 years ago. No take backsies. Okay.
Yeah. Does the British Empire mean nothing to you?
I should make fun of this.
Speaking of empires. Let's talk about the Assyrian Empire.
Yeah.
Because the Assyrians. Okay. So two things I took away from walking through all the Assyrian exhibits. First off, they loved writing stuff on walls.
They did.
Because most of the Assyrian exhibits, I would say, while a lot of the other exhibits that we saw were statues and carved things, like, you know, I guess little statuettes and things like that, right? But a lot of the Assyrian stuff really was wall carvings.
Yeah.
And depictions of events.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I maybe it's that because that's how the collection was.
Are you thinking of like that hallway where you walked down and it was just like lined with the.
But there was more than one of those.
Yes, there was. There was multiple. Yeah. And they were so beautifully detailed.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Those were amazing.
Yeah. Those were really cool. And just like the inscriptions on them and it was just amazing. And there was also a couple of. Now, they were reconstructions because they didn't have. They had pieces and then they reconstructed based on some of the pieces. But some of these depictions of these like doors and entranceways to some iconic temples that we're talking about were just amazing to see the scale of these things. The doors that I was talking about are from Nineveh.
Yeah.
Nineveh is an Assyrian capital.
Yeah. And they are, I think they were those reconstructions.
They were reconstructions because some of the metalwork on the doors were what was found.
Exactly. Yeah.
And they
obviously the
reconstructed
wood would be gone.
Yeah, they reconstructed the doors from the metalwork and it was just
they're gigantic.
So cool.
The scale is so big. And the thing that most caught me about the Assyrians is the winged bull sculptures that they have. They are, again, gigantic. And do you know what they remind me of? Mm. I don't think I told you this while we were there because we were like really hardcore listening to the audio tour. They remind me of the big sculptures not sculptures, but the statues that guard the entrance to like whatever gate that Atreyu was going to.
Oh my God.
In
Neverending Story.
Neverending Story. Do you remember the ones I'm talking about? The ones that talk to him, like the Oracle things or whatever.
Yeah.
I haven't watched that movie in 30 years, so please forgive me for getting some of those details wrong. But that's what those guys reminded me of. And they are just these huge like guardian statues or sculptures or whatever. And my favorite part about them is they have basically five legs instead of four legs. And that's so when you look at them from the front, mm-hmm. they look like they're sitting. Yeah. But when you look at them from the side, they look like they're walking. And yeah. they achieve that like optical illusion by putting in a fifth leg on the side view. So anyway, such a like cool little like artistic thing that they did, which, I loved it.
That was really cool. Okay, so just moving through a few of the other things that we saw that were kind of cool was there's something that's called the, I'm going to get this name wrong here, King Ashurbanipal's Flood Tablet. Okay, now this tablet was, there was a whole big group around this and we couldn't really even get close to it. So I took a picture like over a bunch of people's heads.
Yep.
But it's in the Assyrian wing sort of. Because it's 7th century BC.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm going to read just a little part of what I took a picture of here. And it says, the cuneiform text on this clay tablet is startlingly similar to the biblical story of Noah and his ark in the book of Genesis. It was first translated in 1872 in the British Museum. And this person, George Smith, when he translated it, jumped up and rushed about the room in great state of excitement and began, and to the astonishment of those present, began to undress himself. I don't know why. Yeah. So
maybe he took his coat off. Wouldn't that be undressing yourself in the 1870s?
I guess.
Taking your coat off.
Yeah. Says the tablet describes how the gods sent a flood to destroy mankind and all that. So now this may sound familiar because in very small text, and they don't really describe this in the primary text here. This says late Assyrian, 7th century BC, excavated at Nineveh, northern Iraq, by Sir Austin Henry Layard, who is one of those gentleman sort of, you know, archaeologist before archaeology was a term.
Archaeologist isn't quite the right word, but
It wasn't really a word then.
Excavator.
And this says tablet 11 of the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
Which you may have heard of.
Just a time or two.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's
now amazing. The Epic of Gilgamesh, I believe, is thought to be one of the oldest stories ever written down and
a flood
kind of predates the flood story.
I don't know.
It's one of the earliest, but
it is an early one. And it's a very similar flood story to what's in the Bible. So, there's just a lot of similarities between a lot of those flood.
It does
stories.
Say in the write up here, versions of this story are known from at least 1,000 years earlier. At this point.
Well, there's flood stories that have been, in different cultures around the world for as long as you can think. But Gilgamesh in particular, just to see a tablet, with part of the Gilgamesh story is just really, really, again, it's iconic, right? That's the kind of stuff you get to see when you go to the British Museum. It's amazing. Right.
We're going to talk about two more really cool things we saw in segment three, sort of really big things that are at the British Museum.
Yep.
One of the things I want to mention right before we end this segment, though, and it's just in a small little corner, and you actually miss it if you don't come around the side of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually was looking for it, and I actually used either Gemini or ChatGPT, probably Gemini, to ask, what are some of the big things? What are some of the most iconic things you need to see at the British Museum? And this was mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Lindau Man.
Yeah.
And Lindau Man is a bog body.
Yeah.
And I've never seen a bog body.
Me either.
Yeah.
We talk about him all the time.
I know.
We talked about bog butter, I think, even, didn't we? Or maybe that was Archaeo Animals, but it just keeps coming up.
Yeah. But Lindau Man was found naked, except for a fox fur armband that he was wearing.
Yeah.
Says he was about 1.73 meters tall. So he weighed about 64 kilograms. He was about 25 years old when he died, was well groomed with a beard. That's about all I have. But he looks super crazy. They put him in this enclosed. Yeah, yeah. He's in this enclosure.
Yeah.
And they put him kind of in a bog-like, rocks.
Yeah.
Just to make him look like he's kind of submerged.
Probably
but he's kind of flattened.
He would have been when they excavated him. Yeah.
Right. It's just really crazy and kind of cool to see a bog body.
It's a little bit creepy.
Yeah.
Because it is like you're looking at a a dead person.
Right.
The bog bodies have the features are so recognizable. You're not looking at just the skeleton. There's more of the person left. So, and it's clearly that this encased thing that he's in is somehow in a very controlled environment that's probably keeping him from decomposing. So it has to be that way.
There's a temperature thing in the corner.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think they said he was like violently beaten to death too, right? Wasn't that his,
I can't remember. Yeah. Something like
I'm
that.
I'm pretty sure it was like and so there was speculation on the little write up about him. Like, was it like a punishment? And then they, you know,
chucked him in the bog.
Chucked him in the bog, or like what happened there? Who knows?
Just hope some little coffee shop where he was found has Lindau buttered scones. We'll be back in a bit.
Oh, God.
Welcome back to segment 3 of episode 300. It's meaningless, except for in Sparta.
I'm going to cut all that out.
No, you're not. No, you're not. It's pivotal to the episode.
Oh my God.
Yes. All right. So we're going to talk about two more things, even though we saw a lot more stuff at the British Museum, including
so much more,
including high tea in the, in the restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which we bought ahead of time. You don't necessarily have to, although it was packed in that little restaurant.
You definitely need a reservation.
You need a reservation.
For sure. If you want to eat there. Yeah. And we knew we wanted to do the tea thing. Just seemed like the right choice while we were at the British Museum to do that.
Right.
Yeah. But they have a whole menu, so you don't have to do that. But yeah, another tip for if you're going, if you want to eat there, get your reservations. It's pricey, so maybe you don't want to eat there. But yeah.
Keep in mind, if you are trying to maximize your time for one day, that took probably 45 minutes of our time away from the museum.
It did.
Yeah.
It
but did. We didn't have to order. We didn't have to do anything. We're like, hey, we bought the tea. Bring it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we ordered a coffee. You actually got tea. I got coffee.
Yep.
And they brought the 3-tiered thing with all the stuff. We didn't have to order or wait. So it was all bought ahead of time. So anyway, it did save us a little bit of time doing that. But we could have had more time in the museum had we just like brought our own snacks.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so two more things that we wanted to talk about are Sutton Hoo, which we've done episodes on.
Yes.
And the Elgin marbles.
Yeah, we got to talk about the Parthenon display and all of the Greek stuff. And I feel like, okay, well, which one do you want to start with?
Well, let's talk about Greece and the Elgin marbles, because the Elgin marbles, I think
Elgin
they're called.
Marbles,
yeah, because we've actually, and we've talked about it on this podcast.
Yeah.
Just for your birthday, we went to Athens.
A year and a half ago.
Yeah, a year and a half ago. And we went to the Acropolis Museum.
We did.
And we saw the actual, well, we saw reproductions.
Well, we saw it's a mixture.
It's a mixture.
So both the British Museum and the Acropolis Museum have a mixture of, of real marbles and casts.
And when they say marbles, they just mean the marble from the Parthenon.
Yeah, like the bands of carvings that were around the roof and just below the roof. They're friezes. And there's a couple other words for the different places that they were at. But it's those just stunning statues that are on the triangular shaped piece
at the ends.
On the one end.
Yeah.
And then the friezes that go all the way around.
Yeah.
And there's definitely some controversy there.
First, who did it better? I'm serious.
That's true.
I'm serious.
True.
I think the British Museum and the Acropolis Museum both tried to make it kind of look like the Parthenon.
They arranged
inside.
Them.
They arranged them
in the same way they would have been.
But I got to say, the Acropolis Museum made you feel like you were standing in the Parthenon.
They did.
They almost did it to scale.
And
I feel like one of the reasons for that is the Acropolis Museum was purpose built to look like the Parthenon.
Yeah, and its main goal is to display the artifacts from the Acropolis, from the Parthenon, from the other temples that are there, because they can't be outside anymore.
Yeah.
They're being outside is destroying them. So most of them have been taken down at this point. So there's reproductions up in some cases, like the temple that has the ladies on it, the ladies that are holding up the roof or whatever, those are all reproductions. But a lot of it is has just been taken down because it can't be out.
But the British Museum, I feel like they put their display up, well, first off, a really long time ago. I don't actually know when the current display has been, how long that's been up in its current location. But they probably had limited flexibility to make this look like the Parthenon. They did the best they could, but it looks less like the Parthenon than the Acropolis Museum. So if you're trying to compare the two, there really is no comparison.
I think it's the scale. That's different because the Acropolis, like the big friezes that are up high. Mm-hmm. They put them up there. They are they are up high. So when you're standing in the museum, you're looking up at these things.
Yeah.
And if you're reading a sign about it, it's down below at eye level, but the actual object is up high. So the British Museum, on the other hand, kept everything at eye level. So you're just walking around the room.
Right.
And things might be in the place they would have been in. And obviously it's not as big as the Parthenon because it couldn't possibly be. But it's all at eye level. So you don't get that scale of how much above your head it would have been when it's on the building.
Interesting you mentioned that, because whether it was in text or in the audio guide, they actually mentioned the fact that for, you know, countless centuries, even the highest elites of Greek society could not get as close to those images and those statues that common British people could.
Yeah.
Because they took them and put them
and put them at eye level
on display and put them at eye level. Yeah. It was really interesting that for well over 1,000 years, nobody could see them at that
for the people,
detail.
The people who created them. And they made them for a reason like that. And this is a temple. It's a sacred space. So it wasn't really meant to have people just walking by, like staring it down. That's not what it was meant for. It was a sacred space for a goddess. It was Athena, right? So, but their purpose, the people who created these marbles, the purpose for them and the temple was obviously way different than what they are to us today. We're a different people. The modern Greek people are different people, and so are modern British people. So I think it's fine that they're displayed differently than they would have been. But
one of the really cool things though about seeing them in that way in the British Museum is that the audio guide mentions on, you know, when you're walking through and you're looking at some of the displays, there's one side that has a lot of people on chariots with horses and things like that. And they mention the artistry and the purposefulness behind the carvings and like the linear nature of where the heads are and the hooves and the lines and just how things are lined up.
Mm-hmm.
There's little way you could really see that without being eye level with it.
Yeah.
Right. And with being eye level with it, you can really see how everything was lined up to get these carvings and everything just so, right? It was it was really well done and easy to see that way.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
I mean, I did think it was displayed quite well, and I liked being that close to be able to see it
from a
appreciation of the art standpoint, you know?
Yeah.
But we do have to talk about the controversy.
Lord Elgin.
Yeah.
Lordy, lordy, lordy.
Lordy, lordy.
Yeah. So
Thomas Bruce was the 7th Earl of Elgin. So that's where the Elgin marble name comes from.
Yeah.
And in the early 1800s, he was in Athens. He was checking out all of the amazing sculptures at the Parthenon and noticed that they weren't maybe being taken care of as well as they should have been for a lot of reasons, because Greece was going through some stuff. Then they were occupied by the Turks.
Yeah.
Like there was just some stuff going on and they weren't in a position to like protect and conserve the marbles the way they should have been and the way that Lord Elgin thought they should have been. And he saw an opportunity. Clearly an opportunist, that guy. And he carved out a deal he had permission.
Carved out.
Oh God, carved. Yes. he carved out a deal with apparently the Turks who were occupying Greece. So not the Greeks themselves. And to take all these marbles back to Britain.
The Turks are like, yeah, take them, whatever.
Yeah. Like, we don't care.
Yeah.
So that's the very quick, very brief, probably completely incomplete story of how they ended up in Britain. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I got that from the AI overview on Google. So like, you know, that's where I learned that information. But the problem since then has been that Greece is not occupied anymore. They are their own country. They've built this amazing, beautiful museum to house all of the artifacts from the Acropolis and the Parthenon. And they don't need help from anybody. They don't need somebody to save these marble statues and friezes anymore. They can do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, hey, so when you guys took that, it like wasn't really us that told you could have it. It was like these other guys who said it, and yeah, we want them back. So that is, that's what Greece says. And then the British Museum position basically is that they were acquired legitimately because the Turks were in charge of the country at that moment.
Right.
Occupiers or not, whatever they were doing, they were making the decisions for that area. So it was legal. And also, like, the British Museum, it's like part of their permanent collection. It's something that draws people to the British Museum, and it would harm the museum status as a universal museum of world cultures to have to send them back. And
they've got a lot of stuff.
They've got a lot of stuff. The Rosetta Stone, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, man. Like, well, I do know they should give them back. That's it's a pretty simple thing, but I also understand why they don't want to. I get why they don't want to, but it at this point, it's like, I mean, it's such a complicated problem and a complicated question. And like, what are they, what, if the British Museum starts handing things back, like what kind of slippery slope are they going down at that point?
Yeah.
But I feel like there has to be some kind of compromise where they work out a deal where maybe it's like part-time here, part-time there. I don't know. Like there are examples.
Oh, they'd be so hard to move.
Yeah, they would. They're very heavy and very fixed.
Fragile.
The way they are. Yeah, and fragile. But there has to be some kind of compromise that could be worked out.
Yeah.
Other museums have done it. Other places around the world have done it. So there has to be some compromise. But I don't know what that is, obviously. But yeah, that's the controversy. What do you think? Do you think they should give him back?
I mean, I think they should give him back because the, you know, in some cases when the country of ownership asks for them back, whether or not you agree with whether or not they should ask for them back is not really the point, right? Mm-hmm. If you're just talking about whether or not the country of origin can take care of them, even if that's the point of it.
Yeah.
It's also not even the question, right? But in this case, the Acropolis Museum would just slot them into where they've got them.
Yeah, they have a place for them.
They have a place for them.
They built the museum in a way that those marbles can go right where they should be.
Yeah.
You know, and complete the picture of what the Parthenon looked like. So
they can just slot them right in.
They have the space.
And they belong there.
Yeah. And they've almost left it empty, I think, as like a statement, right?
Yeah.
Like these should be here, but they're not because colonialism.
For sure.
Yeah.
I feel like Egypt is, as they finish the Grand Egyptian Museum, mm-hmm. I think it's called, is going to start doing a lot of that.
Yeah.
You know, they're really going to start hammering the British Museum for a lot of the stuff that they've got and other museums, too.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
There's lots of places around the world.
The British Museum is not the only one.
Yeah. So
I guess there is a part of me that like, I mean, the British Museum is an amazing place to go visit, and you don't want to see it basically like plundered by countries that want all their stuff back, because that would be very devastating to them.
Well, but the British Museum was filled, so to speak, during a time when the British Empire was the British Empire.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, if the Roman Empire had a museum at the time they were the Roman Empire and filled this museum with all kinds of things, guess who'd be taking their crap back?
Right.
Right now, from Italy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people would be.
Yeah.
A lot of countries would be.
Yeah.
So the British Museum just needs to take stock of the fact that they're no longer the British Empire.
Well, it's not only that, it's just that the way that they treated people that were colonized by the British Empire, or that they were, you know, taking things from, was not okay. 150 years ago, it was not okay.
And the thing is, you know, in a lot of cases, it wasn't even, quote, the British Empire that was doing it. It was these lords,
these gentlemen,
and
gentlemen
excavators and scholars and things like
gentlemen
that,
researchers, or
whatever. That were just doing stuff. And the British Museum was like, okay, you know, I'll take it,
right?
Yeah, so
and they ended up getting things like by donation half the time or whatever, too, like from the estates of these people. So,
before provenance was really, you know, a concern.
I think for me, yes, definitely everything should be given back when it's asked for and if there's a valid reason to. But I would just like to see it be done in a way where, like, I just would like to see some compromise in it, you know, because you don't want the British Museum to be dismantled and not be what it is now. Because right now it's this amazing place where you can go to learn about so many ancient cultures.
Yeah.
And that is a really cool thing to have.
But the entire idea behind a museum, which is the housing of things, mm-hmm. you know, from other cultures, basically, that you can go learn about, it's almost always, almost all museums are kind of based on the British Museum and this thought of doing that kind of thing. But here's the thing. Britain itself has its own amazing history that they could just fill that whole thing. The British Museum should be full of British stuff.
Yeah, that's you know? True.
They could so fill that entire room full of British things.
Right.
You know, did we see a Stonehenge exhibit at the British Museum? No, we did not.
Good point.
I mean, we didn't really go through a lot of the Europe stuff too quickly because that was one of the things we kind of had to skip a little bit.
Yeah, we didn't have time.
Yeah. It was just too much. And they did have Europe and Iron Age and some other things in there, but it was almost an afterthought.
Yeah.
Right? It's the British Museum. It should have British things.
Could you imagine like if they dedicated that whole Parthenon room to Stonehenge and like recreating it?
Build a replica of Stonehenge in there.
Yeah. Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, it doesn't need to be a place that houses artifacts from all the ancient cultures.
Yeah.
It can have plenty. Like I said, it's interesting that I was blown away by all the mummies that they had from Egypt. And it was just like mummy, 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 mummy. And it was like almost too many. I can't even remember specifics about anyone in particular because we saw so freaking many of them. Yeah. Well, they don't need that many. They don't. They really don't. So if Egypt ever comes knocking and wanting those mummies back, if they haven't already, I don't know. I didn't research it. Then again, there's got to be a compromise there where maybe they can keep a handful of them, maintain their exhibit so that they're showing, you know, all the different ways that death was handled in Egypt, but like give back a good portion of them too.
Yeah.
So there has to be some kind of compromise. And while eventually there will be, because, you know, Greece is not backing down on wanting their marbles back. So
that's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on from that because this episode has gone on way too long. So
it is. I'm going to really hate when I'm editing this later, like a lot.
Right. So one of the big things we wanted to talk about last was the Sutton Hoo exhibit, which I was actually kind of shocked how much space this was given. Again, British things.
Yeah.
This is a very British thing.
It is.
It's
from their soil.
It is.
British. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing, amazing site. And these artifacts are really awesome.
And they gave a lot of space to this.
They did.
Like they basically put up almost an outline of what this ship would have looked like because we don't really have it. We don't really have the ship anymore. Well, they don't have it here in the museum, but they do have the artifacts from Sutton Hoo.
And like real quick, if you're not familiar with Sutton Hoo, it was a ship burial essentially that was found in ridiculously good condition and fully excavated, I think in Sutton Hoo, right? Isn't that why it's called Sutton Hoo, you know, site or whatever. And there's a whole movie made about it a couple years back, which we talked about. And I think we've done a couple episodes on it.
We've talked about it a lot.
Yeah. It does come up every once in a while in the news cycle too, because it's just a really, really amazing example of a ship burial where there was a really important person, some kind of leader who was buried inside a replica of a ship essentially. So,
So they have some artifacts from here that are talked about anytime you research or look at Sutton Hoo.
Yeah.
One of them is the mask that the person would have worn. They have what's really cool is they have a reconstruction of what the mask would have looked like fully formed, which was really neat.
Yeah.
But then they have all the pieces of the mask that were recovered kind of in one of those, like they do old, you know, old skulls and things like that, where they have the whole skull and they have the pieces of the skull and you can tell where the missing bits are.
Yeah. They have like a base like shape and then they put the
pieces around it.
You can see what's missing too.
Yeah. So that's really neat. Like putting together a puzzle.
Yeah.
They also have the part of the shield and this staff that was all this was kind of crushed and inside this ship burial, but it was all put together and
it's like a big puzzle that was reconstructed.
And it was just, I thought it was really cool. Just actually getting it to be able to see all that stuff. Right.
Oh yeah. I mean, we've talked about it so many times and to see it in person is just, you know, it's once in a lifetime, right? Like, it's amazing.
And when the Sutton Hoo people ask for that back, I hope the British Museum. Yeah. No, well, but this is what I'm talking about. The British have so much cool stuff.
Great history.
Great history.
Yeah.
And they can put it all in the British Museum.
Yeah. Well, and I'm super glad to see how much space was dedicated to this really important discovery, because it just shows that like they can fill a museum with amazing things that are acquired legally or from their own place.
Yeah. So one of the last things that we will just mention as we're closing out this show is the Moai statue from Rapa Nui, aka Easter Island.
Right.
Yes.
A big head.
A big head.
One of the big
the head and body.
Heads. Oh, yeah. This one has body. Yeah.
With surprisingly small nipples. I got to say, they really stick out. I don't know what to tell you. But they're just like, why make the nipples like that? I don't know what to tell you. Yeah. No. So the story of this thing is really crazy. I mean, this British ship was there basically. Yeah. And they're like, basically, I mean, I'm going to paraphrase, but they basically were like, hey, can we take one?
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, sure. We'll help you get it on your boat.
Yeah. And it was like, so it's a smaller one.
Yeah, it's definitely a smaller one.
Yeah. But like,
what is this? Maybe 10 feet tall or something like that.
Yeah. Enough that they could have like rolled it onto a ship or whatever, however they did it. But it's very interesting because the people who were on the island and who gave it to the British sailors or whoever it was, I guess they just weren't important to them at that time. They are to the cultures that live there today, though.
They want it back.
And they do want it back. It's another thing.
They've been to the British Museum and they're calling it a sacred, one of their sacred statues. And they've done little rites around it. And there's a picture of them. And that's all mentioned here at the exhibit.
Yeah.
But of course, the British Museum is like, we're in talks.
Yeah.
Dot, dot, dot. Yeah. It's part of our museum now.
Yeah.
And you gave it to us freely.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't you, it was you.
But that's just.
They really hold on to the, you did it in the past, therefore that holds now.
Yeah. You gave us permission.
No take backs. They really hold to the no take backs.
The no take backs. That is like, that is the entire argument from the British Museum.
It really is like
you said we could.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you were drunk when you said it or whatever. No take backs. Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit immature, actually, that argument when you start thinking about it, you know, because like it's just the whole reason you're revering and displaying these objects is because of the cultures that they represent.
Yeah.
But you're going to turn and look at the descendants of those cultures and say, no, sorry. No. You have no claim here. Bye.
Right.
You know, like it's just so unfair. It really is. So
yeah.
They're
gonna look at him and say, you had thousands and we have one. So yeah. Go make more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, I do see the other side of the argument because it's like, you know, I loved my experience there so much.
Yeah.
I saw so many amazing things. And they were all in one place and it made it really easy for me to see them.
Easter Island's really hard to get to.
But right? But also, I think we have a really unique perspective in that we went to Athens last year too and have seen their museum.
Yeah.
And it makes you realize that like, yes, you can go see these things in the British Museum and that's great. But if you can see them in the place that they were created by the people, you know, the descendants of the people who created them, to just be in that environment, it is so much more impactful.
Yeah.
There's nothing that can compare to going to tour the Parthenon and then walking into the Acropolis Museum and seeing the real versions of all those things.
Right.
Like that, it's just a stunning experience and it trumps the experience of the British Museum 1000%.
For sure.
So I guess that's where I come down is like, you know what? Get your ass to Easter Island and see them there in context.
Yeah.
It's where they're meant to be seen.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
So.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we got more British stuff coming up in future episodes. We may pepper in a news episode here and there, but we did see a lot of cool stuff.
We did.
So but at least two more episodes coming. Maybe one if we slam it all in.
Maybe one if we kind of. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see how we do.
Yeah.
We saw some cool stuff. I mean, we saw Bath. Yeah. We saw
Stonehenge.
Yeah.
We already talked about that a little bit.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. So anyway. All right. Well, with that, we will call it. Thanks for joining us on our 300th episode.
Woohoo!
Here's to an arbitrary number of episodes more.
I thought you were going to say 300 more. And like, I thought my heart was going to seize up for a second because I don't know if I have another 300 in me. That's so many episodes.
All right. On a side note, we're looking for another co-host to the show. So
okay, we'll just keep, let's just yeah. like take it day, take it week by week.
Yes, week by week or yep. week by other week.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. See you later.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.